your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
You know, when I watch TV and they have guests on the show who either were career successes or had career problems, you know, I watch Dr. Phil or any of them, everything is nice and pat. It's completely orchestrated and antiseptic. But in the real world, career problems don't have such black and white answers. And after all, this is public radio. We're the land of nuance. And so I thought I would take seven common career dilemmas that do not have an easy answer. But maybe the best we can do is to lay out some pros and cons and then throw it back to you. You've got to decide what, you know, what's right for you. But at least maybe you'll have heard a few more pros and cons laid out. Some are obvious, some not. And so that it isn't just my voice or my thoughts on pros and cons, I have my usual co-conspirator here, a frequent co-conspirator, not usual, that's a little strong. She's on once a month. The Napa County Office of Education Superintendent and my wife, Dr. Barbara Nemko. Is that short enough of an introduction, Barbara?
I'm sorry. That was good. Yes, thank you.
Not a lot.
More than sufficient.
I didn't talk about all your awards or any of that stuff.
Thank you.
Okay. Anyway, so I thought what we would do is I would talk about the there are seven. I'll trot out one, and then you react to it. You can either agree or amplify, or, you know, it's like simply agree, just yes, and then move on, or amplify or disagree. How's that sound?
Sounds perfect.
Okay. One of the big dilemmas, of course, is being self-employed. Many people feel that, you know, either by choice or because they just haven't been able to land a job that pays a decent enough living, that they need to try to be self-employed. After all, you don't need to get permission. You don't need to pay dues. You go instantly from schlepper to CEO. You have no boss to answer to. And as you feel like it, on a dime, you can change your business, anything aspects of it. You get pride of ownership. You get to be in control. And yet, on the other hand, it's well known that most businesses go out of business, and quickly. The more the following, I'm going to tick off a bunch of things here that are characteristics of the successful self-employed person. And I'm not talking about self-employed as in some big, scalable 50-person, 500-person business. I'm talking about the one-person, two-person, four-person business. Am I wrong, Barbara? You sound like you're eating.
No, I am not. That
okay.
is not
I'm hearing,
true.
Hearing clicking and various things, so I don't know what it is.
Nope.
Okay, then whatever it is, maybe you're playing with your pencil. Anyway, these are some of the things that seem to differentiate successfully self-employed people in the one or few person business from those who are less successful. So the more of the following that describe you, the better your prospects. You got to be a self-starter, not a procrastinator, because as they say, time is money, and the meter doesn't stop ticking while you're procrastinating. You also have to have a nose for what will sell that's well beyond, well, I like it. You've got to deal with the marketplace. If it's a business, it's not just people who are just like you. Generally, you have to go well beyond that, although it can be a long tail. It doesn't have to be to the general public, but you've got to really put aside the self-absorption about what taste is and look more broadly, doing market research. And if you're going to run a business, it's got to reflect what the market wants, or you're going to be out of business. Otherwise, you got a hobby. You can do what you like, but then you got a hobby. Another element of the successful self-employed person is that you've got to be capable enough to handle most of a business's elements. You got to be pretty good at sales, whether you're actually selling or you're negotiating a better price with a vendor. That's sales. You're convincing them to give you better terms. You've got to know something about marketing. You got to, and especially in these days, it seems as though search engine optimization and social media marketing are hegemonic, especially with somebody, you know, in the segment of the population that does most of the buying, which is young folk. Then there are myriad problems you can't even anticipate. Just crap happens, and you have to be able to be quick enough on your feet intellectually to be able to solve those problems. You can't afford to hire every time something goes wrong. You even have to have basic accounting skills or IT skills. And you're both committed to And you have to have a talent for buying low and selling high while remaining ethical. Not so high that it's usurious, but and knowing when you don't always buy the cheapest or spend a lot of time to try to save $5. But there is, I have seen again and again, some people just don't have that desire or instinct or whatever about how to get things really cheaply. In other words, closer to the cost of manufacture than some phony inflated wholesale price that's really pretty damn close to retail. So that's, to me, what should help somebody decide whether they should be self-employed. Barbara, agree or amplify, disagree, your thoughts?
Well, I totally agree with all of the elements that you said. I think being self-employed is so much more challenging than having a job with parameters around it and hours around it and a place that you get to go to and people that you get to talk to. There's a whole social component to having a job that's very important to most people. And the only thing that I would amplify is you have to know your potential for staying on task versus your distractibility.
Yeah.
Because when you're at work, the fact that there are other people are going to, and the fact that you've gone to some other place, you're not at home, are the things that will stop you from taking a break to do the laundry or noticing that the kitchen floor needs to be mopped or that you want to take a run because it's a really perfect day and this would be a good time to put on your jogging clothes. You won't do that. But when you're home, it's much easier to get swept into that, and you can really putter away a lot of time and get nothing accomplished.
Yep. On the other hand, if you're working for an organization, if you fritter away a little time, usually you're not going to get fired, and it's not going to make you go out of, you know, you, it's not on you, it's the company's dime or the nonprofit's dime or the taxpayer's dime in case of government. Whereas if you are self-employed, it's all on you. So that tends to, for some people, tends to make them more motivated to not procrastinate because they're terrified of going out of business. So they tend to be more focused because they've got, as the new Nicholas Taleb book says, they've got skin in the game.
Well, interesting perspective. I guess that's true. But again, you have to know that you're the kind of person who can stay focused
That's right. Some people can't. Okay, let's go to another of the common career dilemmas. First, I'll let our listeners know. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. We are exploring seven common career dilemmas that don't have pat answers. And we thought that the best we could do is lay out some pros and cons, and which would hopefully enable you to make a more informed choice. So a second of these common career dilemmas is, should you go for the money or not? I mean, the standard argument is that beyond a bare middle-class living, you can't buy your way to contentment. And that's true for many people. But, on the other hand, I have seen some people who figured, hey, it's not like I can make it even a bare middle-class living doing something I love, like playing music or being an activist. So I might as well go for the big bucks and be a bond trader or insurance broker or whatever. And some of them end up feeling great about that decision. They may volunteer their time or money and give it to their nonprofit thing of choice, or they may be a rock musician as a hobby, but they feel good about not worrying about being able to pay the rent. The question is, should you go for the money, or should you, you know, this may sound crazy, you may not believe me, but I swear it's true, dear listeners. If I was starting again, I probably would just, I would not gone to college, probably dropped out of high school because it was so boring, all of that stuff. And I would have just started learning on my own and then writing. And if I had to make a living, I'd work in a bookstore. And if I needed to work minimum wage, make minimum wage, I would live in a basement apartment if I needed to, that had was dripping before I sat through all those years of PhD land or even college land. But most people think that's crazy here, in, especially in America, in, you know, money-driven, materialism-driven, capitalist America. Barbara? What are your any agreement, disagreement about the going for the money issue, the amplifications, disagreement, your thoughts?
I'm one of those materialist, capitalistic people who say, you're nuts. Of course you should go for the money. I think that the other things are things that you can do as a hobby. So nobody says you have to give up your music, your theater, your sports, all the other things that you really, really love. But if you know that the likelihood of your making a living at it is pretty small, then you have to be willing to live in a very basic fashion. And while I know you could do that, and yep. you would probably like doing that,
I tolerate it.
You could do that by yourself. I'm not doing that with you.
I know.
And so that's the other piece, that do you want to live alone and live that lifestyle, or are you going to be fortunate enough to find a significant other who agrees with your bare minimalist lifestyle?
Right. I understand. I do want to make a point. I didn't mean to just blanket dismiss capitalism as all evil. I think that's also too nuanced, too not nuanced, too black and white. You know, capitalism does, because of the price pressures, enable people to afford, you know, things that they, in most cultures that are not capitalistic, or at least a mixed economy, there is, you know, great shortages, and there's lack of incentive, and people feel empty because they don't have, there is no competition. So, you know, capitalism has its advantages, but so, you know, and eventually, as Margaret Thatcher said, the problem with socialism is eventually you run out of other people's money. So I am
exactly
a true moderate,
right.
And I have mixed feelings about the benefits of capitalism and socialism, which puts me in the camp of moderately regulated capitalism with a healthy safety net. So anyway, I thought that was fair.
I think that's what they call America.
Yeah. Well, even under Trump, I think we're certainly moving. If one looks at the mega trend, we've certainly had a larger amount of the economy that is being taken over by public interest. I think about, of course, both of us were in education for a long time. Student loans used to be administered by banks. The Obama administration simply with an executive order, I believe, simply said, nope. No more banks. We're going to do it. The government's going to take the place of the banks. And I think there's a lot of that. A lot of what used to be private business are now, quote, public-private partnerships. I think about development. Private developers now are very rarely have much freedom to develop because the government mandates there's going to be X percentage of low-income housing. You're going to pay X amount of money for infrastructure. You're going to do it to these codes or whatever. So I think America is moving to a... Believe it or not, notwithstanding Donald Trump, who I think at most he'll finish his term, but he's being hamstrung at every turn, we are moving in a direction where more will be government run. Even the percentage of kids in private schools are down. So that's, I think we're headed toward a more Sweden-like environment, even though Sweden is talking about its being bankruptcy and suffering a great deal of, let's just say, challenges. As the population changes and immigration and all those interesting things.
But that's why we have what you said, a somewhat regulated capitalism with a safety net. And
yeah.
So the safety net's getting a little larger and the regulation's getting a little larger, but we still are not, we may be getting there, but we're not in a position
Absolutely.
Where we are like Sweden.
Fair enough. Okay. There's a corollary. I was trying to lay out pros and cons of going for the money. There is a corollary dilemma, which is, should you work for a for-profit or a non-profit? Well, conventional, now I'm going to sound like a lefty, but conventional wisdom today is that corporations are evil. They're out to maximize shareholder profits and executive profits, exacerbating the gap between haves and have-nots, rich and poor, the income inequality, at the expense of the public, at the expense of the environment. And there is some truth to that. On the other hand, many, if not most, shareholders are just plain folks like psychologists and tradespeople and teachers like you who worked hard for every dollar, and by investing in corporations like Google or Toyota or Disney, whatever, they've got a shot at paying for their kids' college education, although that's no guarantee with these crazy prices of college education these days. And being able to look toward retirement at some point if they want it. And if you work for a corporation, you're more likely to make a good living than if you're working for a nonprofit, which usually pays poorly, but expects you to put in huge hours because you believe in the cause, after all. And besides, as I alluded to briefly earlier, corporations being efficient enables even low-income people to afford everything from toilet paper to tomatoes to a TV. I was just looking, we have already a nice TV, but I was looking online. A 65-inch TV now is $650. A 55-inch TV you can get for $400. I mean, that's
pretty incredible.
Pretty incredible. The smartphone. I mean, no, you're not going to get an iPhone X inexpensively, but cheapskate that I was, I bought last year, I bought an iPhone 5S, which is perfectly wonderful, for $129. And then there's the baby aspirin that older adults take to prevent heart attacks. Each aspirin costs just a few pennies. But back on the other hand, I want to make sure I'm fair to both sides. Nonprofits help, as the New Testament says, quote, the least among us. So the argument goes, how can a person work for a company that makes anything not essential when there are people starving in Africa? So that lays out both sides. The question is, what's right for you, for-profit or nonprofit work? Okay, Barbara, your thoughts, your amplifications, disagreements, what do you want to say?
I think if you are someone who wants to help, you probably can do that better and make more of a difference if you go for the money and then donate a lot of it back, because that's direct cash that will help people to pay their rent, eat, whatever. If you are trying to not worry about money and do what you love, I'm not sure who you're helping.
Well, that's the Bill Gates model. I mean, he made $1 zillion selling software.
Right. And look what he's done. I mean, he's curing diseases in other countries. He's getting people to have clean drinking water. So that's how you really make the big difference.
Okay. I want to do one more of these career dilemmas. And then, dear listeners, we're going to go to you and get your reactions, agreement, disagreements, or simply you can call in for a workover. That is the core function, or a core function, certainly, of the show, which is whatever career conundrum is besetting you or someone you care about, you call in, I ask you a few questions, and usually I can help you take a step forward, sometimes just a baby step, sometimes a large one. But get yourself ready for that if you'd like, or to comment on anything we've said. But first, I want to run down one more of these common career dilemmas. Should you become an expert? Many people, it's almost an article of faith. Oh, yes, you need to become an expert and just do what Malcolm Gladwell says. You have to put the 10,000 hours and you become an expert. But that begs the question of whether it's worth it. It takes a hell of a lot more effort and sustained focus to become an expert instead of just competent. Is it worth it? True, being an expert is going to make you more in demand. True, you may become more competent and in turn more confident, which feels great. But for you, is the time to get expert worth it? Would you rather, for example, just be competent but put more of your efforts, as many people choose to do, to have work-life balance, to have time to be a dedicated parent, to be a dedicated romantic partner, to be a dedicated activist, to be a dedicated sports athlete person or Pilates aficionado? So it's really not an article of faith so quickly for everybody that you should follow the standard advice. You should aim to be an expert at something. Barbara, your thoughts?
I guess, like everything else, it's a very nuanced question. A, it depends on how much time and money it's going to take you and your ability level to get to be an expert in something. If it's something that with not too much extra effort and not a whole lot of money, you can reach that status, and that will afford you more choices, more opportunities for the work that you want to do, then I would say go for it, and you'll have that time later to be the dedicated romantic partner and parent. But if it's a long road ahead and you can get a good job being competent, I'm not sure it's worth taking years and lots of money and all that time to. Then it also depends on what age you are at the time.
Yep.
Maybe when you're 21, it's worth putting in 4 more years. But if you're 36, this is not a time that you want to go back and do that.
Implicitly, you use the word long road twice. That underpinning that is the whole idea of ability. Sometimes some people are just, we're not supposed to say that we're all supposed to be all equal, but some people learn a lot faster than others. And some people have a natural ability. Like, I can't draw or squat, but I could play the piano really well and I didn't have to practice. So not everybody takes the same amount of time to become expert.
Right.
So what needs to be put into the equation is, how long would it take you to get expert in that which you're considering being expert in? It's like, I could forever try to become a laid-back person like you and calm under pressure when you're a superintendent, and that the odds of me being expert at that are too small to justify my effort at that. Where if I said, you know, I think I want to be one of those people, you know, Audible.com, it's an Amazon company that creates audiobooks. I could, without too much practice, I think become a very good Audible book reader for, say, scholarly books or, you know, intellectually difficult books. Because I, you know, I listen to audiobooks all the time, and sometimes it feels like there are these airheads reading. They don't even understand what they're reading. And so I think I could add some value there. So there, that wouldn't take me very long. So you have to include your ability in this equation of whether it's worth becoming an expert or not. Make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what? One more I want to do. That'll be. We only have one more left in my seven. So, I have two more. So, no, I'll give out the phone number. All right, dear listeners, you've heard five out of the seven common career dilemmas. We've tried to be fair-minded and balanced. As Barbara has. If you want to either, you have two reasons you can call. One is you want to comment on any of these career dilemmas as we've laid them out, to remind you what they are. One, should you be self-employed? Two, should you go for the money and its corollary? Should you work for a nonprofit or for-profit? Should you become an expert at something? Should you, I guess that's all we've done. I guess that's all we've done. So we've got, I guess we have three more. Okay. You want to comment about any of those? Or you are stuck, or someone you love is stuck in your career. Any station in life, I like to use the radio pun, any station in life, whether you're unemployed or well-employed, 16 or 76, whether you are a high school dropout or a postdoc PhD in nuclear physics, I can usually help. And in fact, the more difficult the problem, the better. I like it. After 28 and a half years doing this, it's fun to have a real challenge. So the phone number for all of those reasons to call Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. While we're waiting for the calls to come in, another one of these career dilemmas is, should you get technical? These days, we keep hearing that soft skills usually aren't enough. Technical skills, especially the in-demand ones like artificial intelligence coding, make employers come to you, begging you, actually, rather than you're needing to cajole your way into a decent job. But, on the other hand, many people struggle to get sufficiently technical, and they just don't like technology that much. They certainly like it less than, for example, interacting with people. The question is, you. Do you want to get technical, which will increase your opportunities, or are you willing to bank on your soft skills being good enough to prevail? Barbara, amplification, disagreement?
I think there's a certain level of technical skill that you do need to have in order to survive in today's job market. You are going to be using a lot of tools that require basic technology skills, whether it's an Excel spreadsheet or PowerPoint or Prezi presentation apps. So at Twitter, which has become an important component even for business people. So you have to have some. I don't know that you have to become the expert. We have experts, and they help us get through the tough parts. So if technology isn't your thing, just make sure you have enough that when you enter the workplace, you'll be able to use the stuff that they require of you.
On the other hand, you know, in the last year or two, I've noticed even for jobs that are not very technical, I'm often seeing job descriptions saying basic ability to code in Java or in Python required. Things are ratcheted up. So much is a matter of converting ideas into tech-based processes or apps that are even just for internal use.
May I ask you a question?
Sure.
What kinds of jobs are those and in what fields?
Any manager very often is going to have to say, you know what, I'm going to create a little app to make it easier to streamline a process that, you know, for our fundraising process. They may take, for example, one of the pieces of software that's used in a fundraising game like Razor's Edge, and there may be options for customizing it. And rather than always having to run to the company for that high fee customization, having some basic skills in how to customize some software can often be very valuable. Anyway.
Well, I learned something new tonight.
Well, I would hope so. And I learn from you at all times. Okay. All right. I'll give out the phone number. If you have a work-related problem you want to work over, or you want to comment on any of our takes on these career dilemmas, the phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco, NKALW, 415-841 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hello?
Hello?
Hi.
Oh, hi. I'm so glad to be able to respond to this. I am a small business owner.
Can you speak a little? It sounds like you're in a car. Is there any way you can speak up a little bit or closer
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I've been waiting, and I'm so surprised to hear this from this radio station, because I know it's in Berkeley, and I always think so lefty to the point of nauseam. And I really appreciate Barbara on the show tonight, because, you know, money...
We lost her just as she was appreciating me.
Yes, no, I really do. I think you're very level-headed. And
she is.
I feel, you know, I listen to these programs, and I'm just like, oh, my God, these people are so out of their minds. You know, there's something for everybody. I started as a waitress, okay? I went back to school when I was 27 and studied art. I own two art galleries today. Hmm. I'm a small business owner. Hmm. I have a home. You know, am I a huge corporate? And I do it. My gallery is corporate incorporated. But, you know, as I was driving home this evening, I spent a day. A corporate person helped somebody today. I helped a woman and her son. You know, they had a car accident. And when I went to approach the vehicle, the son was crying, saying he had nowhere to live, that they had just gotten thrown out. And, you know, while I didn't want to take on the world with them, I put them in a hotel for a week so she could figure things out, the mother.
Wow.
And I know. And you know what? I'm not bragging about me, but money helps people, like you were talking about Bill Gates. And, you know, it's got nothing, you know, I'm not a billionaire, but I was able to do something kind and help somebody because I do have some money. In my life.
You said something...
I started from nothing.
You said something interesting. You said that you listen to the radio, and you say you just can't believe it. Is there any one thing that comes to mind that made you... You said everybody's out of touch or just whatever.
Well, especially Berkeley. When I first came here from New York, I was like, I couldn't even go to Berkeley because everybody's so lefty, you know, to the point of, like, you know, they hate people that have money. And it's sick. There's something wrong with them, okay? I embrace everybody. I have clients, I will not name them on the air, but they are billionaires. And God bless them, you know what? They spent $500,000 to go to Stanford University. They worked their butts off. Okay, you think it comes easy? It does not. Okay, unless you're like, you know, a Rockefeller or something. And I even know one of those. I have a very good friend who's a rock star. But that's a whole other story. I mean, these people deserve what they make. They've given up most of their lives. They work huge hours.
It's true.
Sometimes I have to meet these people at 7 a.m. in the morning.
Yep, my clients that way, yep.
Yeah, but, I mean, and, so, you know, I mean, like, let's not badmouth people who have money. And you know what? When I had $10, if you were in need, guess what? You got $5. It's got nothing to do with anybody except for a personal mentality.
You know, one thing I want to comment on amplifying that, you know, it's almost as though a corporation is only worthy if they then give charity. They say the foundation, or you gave $5, or Bill Gates. But, you know, but Trader Joe's is my favorite store, and it is a huge corporation with hundreds of stores. I love Trader Joe's. Just even the process of being there, I enjoy. It's a friendly, lovely place, and I can buy good fruits and vegetables at a fair price. I can buy cheeses at half the price of those frou-frou little mom and pops, and I can afford the full price of the cheese, but many people can't. And corporations like Trader Joe's or Toyota or Whirlpool or Aspirin, Bayer, the company that makes the generic Walmart aspirin that I buy, which is half the price of the brand name, it's not the charity, it's their core business, makes everyone able to live decently. And I think while nonprofits do good work too, it's harder to see sometimes the benefits of the nonprofit. The goals are lovely and certainly charitable and redistributionist. But I know that every customer... I think about the home. We bought a tract house in Napa. If it wasn't really expensive, And I saw all those. It was a family-run corporation that built that little development and enabled us at an afford, because they were large enough to have economies of scale, but they weren't pigs in any way. I saw those workers, the carpenters, the electricians, the drywalls, the plumber people, the landscapers, all of them who on their own could never have built a house, enabled all of us in the development to have a reliable home at an affordable price. And yet when you hear the word developer, you want to just say, oh, good, that is a cash cow. We can see how we can get money from them. Even developers are not bad guys.
I resent that. I think that's wrong. And it says a lot, you know, it says the person who makes that comment. When I hear that, I think, okay, this person, there's, you know, they're coming from lack or hatred or, you know, it's like I've had to learn to, you know, bravo for you. Bravo for you.
Anyway, thank you very much for the call. We've got plenty of calls on the line, so let's go right back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You've raised some really great questions for me because I'm currently in a trade apprentice program for construction, traditional
great.
Construction trades.
Yeah.
With a nonprofit, I have lots of experience across a variety of industries, some of them relating to construction, some to personal wellness, and for example, when you mentioned, do you become an expert, do you put in mm-hmm. the time to mm-hmm. become an expert in something,
right.
This is something I'm up against in my program, because it's mostly geared towards trades where there's a 4 to 6 year pre-apprentice mm-hmm. or apprenticeship
right.
period. And then the wages get pretty good, for sure. But I'm struggling with whether I can roll with that, you know, taking so long out of my life. I'm now in my mid-40s.
Mm-hmm.
Or do I just kind of return to messing around with being a jackass of all trades, basically?
Mm-hmm. I've never heard that phrase before. It's cute. tell me what kind of skills you... What is the level of skill you have in the jackass? I mean, are you a handy person? Are you a, who are you? What are the skill sets you have currently?
Well, I'm a certified yoga instructor. Wow. I'm a certified forklift driver. I've also done a lot of carpentry, metalwork, prop fabrication, long distance driving. So I'm pretty all over the map, and I'm just really looking to hone this collection of skills into something more marketable and stable than just kind of
right.
frittering around for odd jobs and
right.
what have you.
Absolutely. You know, and Barbara, I'll be very interested in hearing your reaction, but I always have this visceral reaction, especially to someone who's beyond their 20s and certainly beyond their 30s, that those 4 to 6 years are the most productive years of a 25-year left work life. If you're spending 6 years making little or nothing to become a newbie, journeyman, it feels like a big risk. I'd rather see you go and, you know, if you were 18, I would say go do the apprenticeship, take the time and get it, really do it all right. But I would take at least a shot at picking some specialty that does pay well, whatever that specialty is that might leverage your, you know, if you are more of a carpenter type person that, you know, you think you have that natural gift for that, I would try to apprentice myself with a master cabinet maker or somebody who's in the high end, so that you're not making $20 an hour, but you can be making $50 an hour. And see, you know, if I could learn on the job from somebody, generally these people who are the most likely to want to spend a lot of time mentoring you are older. Somebody in their 50s or 60s who are starting to see their own aging are more likely to give you the time and feel good about what they call transgenerativity to train, to help you take over the mantle. I remember that in a carburetor shop. Carburetors are obsolete, they don't use fuel injection, but there was an old carburetor shop and an old guy was training a young man who was not academically oriented to learn how to repair carburetors, because there's still some cars that have them. Does that notion appeal to you, of finding some mentor person who in the course of 6 months could teach you a whole lot, and little by little, as you gain more expertise, start to pay you more and more, and then you either stay working for him or her, or go off on your own, or work for another employer?
Absolutely. It's funny that you mentioned that because I have been watching these furniture workers near our program in the last several days, and I keep getting envious, like, oh, you guys are, like, polishing and finishing the wood, and that looks so much fun, and I really enjoy doing that. And I really do enjoy a one-on-one mentorship relationship with somebody, which is something that I'm starting to feel is not going to be the direction of going the traditional trade route, where you're on a list or a hunt situation with a whole lot of other people and don't necessarily have a lot to go on aside from, in my case, being, you know, incentivized as a disadvantaged or, you know, female worker, that sort of thing.
And so, Barbara, I'm very well aware of your presence, but I want one more thing I want to say. I always am listening for the unusual. Most people are not that into polishing and shining and sanding, but the fact that you said that was fun, I love that, because you said that was fun, that says to me that maybe you should be trying to find one of the top-rated Yelp antique refinishers and try making 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 phone calls, relentlessly focused, until you find somebody who you click with, who might let you be an apprentice right there, and little by little you could become an antique refinisher. What do you think?
Oh, that sounds great. I mean, I do have a little experience with that, and there is a little fear handling fragile old items, but I am really fond of being detail-oriented with objects and, you know, being able, having something where I, my skills and my care and my precision can be put to use versus being, you know, quite ham-fisted with the kind of things that happen on a construction site most of the time.
Right, and you just make yourself get desensitized to your fear of the fragile items. Little by little, you know, you could, if you want in the beginning, put a piece of foam rubber underneath so you're not terrified. But little by little, you'll gain more confidence. Barbara Nemco, now please, thank you. You've been very patient. What would you like to say to our dear caller?
I'm delighted that you found something that she's really excited about. I have nothing to add to that.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll give you something to talk about then. I'll just thank this caller. Thanks very much for calling Work with Marty Nemco. Barbara Nemco, we've got two more. I'll give out the phone number again. If you want to have a work-related problem that you'd like our help with, happy to try to do that. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's, of course, Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco, 415-841-4134. Okay, another of those dilemmas, and this is kind of a fun one. I like this one. Should you be audacious? I mean, if you turn on the TV, you're going to likely see audacity pay off. Maybe it's a sitcom in which the worker bee tells off the boss and ends up with the boss's job. Or it's a talk show in which an unemployed dishwasher's brownie recipe gets the sharks to invest $200,000 and now she's a zillionaire. But in the real world, for every audacity that does yield a big win, many, you know, like I think about the people, you know, it used to be on TV, I remember they show some unemployed person with a sandwich board, hire me and have his resume on the sandwich board. But for everyone that makes it on the TV, there is a lot of audacious efforts that fail. The best you can do is to estimate your odds of success and how important the win is to you versus the downside if you lose. For example, let's say you've got a spouse or a parent who would support you, and you're dying to try opening a clothing store. Even if the odds of success are low, you may say, what the hell? What do I have to lose? Or an example like people are always afraid of imposing and being embarrassed and sounding stupid by trying to reach out to an employer who is not advertising a job to try to get either a job created for them or information or develop a relationship, so when a job does become available, they're an inside candidate. But there, if you can accept the fact that the risk-reward ratio is great for trying, you make 20 of those inquiries, you're going to get 17 no responses and maybe one out-and-out rejection, and one or two will talk with you, but you only need one lead to get a job. So as long as you can accept the rejection or being ignored or sounding stupid, which you might, it's worth usually the risk-reward of trying to be audacious, even though it's not the standard way where you'll just post your LinkedIn profile and your resume and answer the ads appropriately. It's worth being audacious in those situations. Barbara, Any amplifications, disagreements?
Well, the word audacious has many meanings. So when you say, is it worth being audacious, the examples that you just gave of trying to walk into an employer's office and say, hello, I wanted to talk to you, I think I would be a great hire, that to me sounds less audacious than some of the other things that that word could convey. So yes, if you are willing to take some risks, that may or may not be considered audacious. That's a good thing to do because you take the risk, and if it doesn't work, you're no worse off than you were before, but there's always a chance that it will. So if that's your definition, I'm all for it.
Well, I do think it's audacious. As I just think back to last week's show, I had a genetic counselor on there, and I asked her, I said, if somebody walked in and said they wanted a volunteer or do an internship in the in your office in the genetic Kaiser Permanente's genetic counseling office, would you think I was crazy? She said yes. So,
right. But again, that doesn't matter because you're no worse off than you were
before. Absolutely, but it's still audacious. Anyway, okay. Let's do one more though. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko. It is your turn on the air. What is on your mind? Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I heard the last caller about the carpentry, mm-hmm. And so that interested me to give you a call. Mm. I am a chef. My background's in nutrition, mm-hmm. and I've mainly done work for myself. I worked in restaurants for several years as well, but I'm trying to get back into the work field. I have a almost two-year-old daughter that I've predominantly been at home with, and I'm trying to get back in, and I'm struggling with basically what the other woman was talking about, finding my combining my skill set to find a position that I feel strong in. And I feel like I'm at the point where I'm wanting to go away from working for myself and finding like a small team of people that I just really feel like I'm, you know, working with a team and feel like we're setting goals and accomplishing things. And I just kind of wanted to see if you had any words or thoughts on, you know, a route that I should take at this point in my life.
There's a number of possibilities that at least for starters, I want to lay out. Well, one of the more obvious ones, and this is not doesn't give you the social thing you want, but it leverages your skills. Being a personal chef to people with diabetes or other conditions that have complicated dietary needs, so that you're working for a few families, and because you got a two-year-old, you can do a lot of your cooking at your own home and then bring the food over there. I'll start with that and then get your reaction, then I have other ideas. What's your reaction to that?
I'm currently doing something similar to that. I actually make meals for moms, and then I also make food for this like high-end tea shop. Because my background is in nutrition, my focus when I do cook is usually for, you know, people that are either really into nutrition or people that do have dietary, you know, needs. So that's pretty much what I am doing, and I'm just feeling like that's only going to last so long. It is working right now, but I'm kind of wondering more of the, you know, the longevity of what I should be kind of focusing on now that will lead me into a more concrete career as, you know, my daughter also gets older.
Right.
Would you like to teach?
Teach cooking?
Yeah. There's more and more of that happening in schools. There are culinary programs in high schools all over the place. They're even doing that in elementary and middle schools. We have the whole farm-to-table movement in California, and the concern over good nutrition has really spurred many new positions for people who can teach cooking. But it's not just cooking. It is clearly cooking and good nutrition.
I actually do like teaching. I was an ESL teacher at one point in my life, and I absolutely loved it. So I do like teaching. My hesitation around that is the pay. I feel like I haven't found a company that seems like they pay well enough in the Bay Area for that.
couple of thoughts. First of all, public schools pay much better in the Bay Area than you might think. They start at 50 and they end up getting close to 100. Am I correct, Barbara, that teachers can make up 100,000?
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But more even, but to leave you with as many options as possible, I was actually thinking of being a institutional chef at a place where nutrition is really critical, whether it be the schools or it be an assisted living facility. As the boomers are aging, there are, of course, endless numbers of assisted living facilities where they use chefs. And I'm wondering where that would give you the corporate stability you want, and you're part of a team. What are your thoughts about those ideas?
Yeah, I never thought about that. Cool. I like that idea.
I'll quit while I'm ahead. Well, thank you very much for calling Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko,
of course. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Let's take one more.
That was a great idea.
I do my best. Let's. I have one more of those dilemmas. I want to make sure we get through them all, and then we'll go back to the phones or not. We'll see. I deliberately left this career dilemma for last because we've covered it so much, but I would be remiss because it's to not include because it's so common. Should you get a degree or an additional degree? We all know that today a degree no longer confers as big an advantage in the job market as it used to. And the amount of useful learning for all that time and money is often astonishingly low. I cited many studies in the past. I won't repeat them here again today. But yet still, most employers still value degree holders. They don't all say, you know, I just want you to be able to be a good thinker. They seem to, because it's an objective way to screen people immediately that can't be called racist or sexist or whatever. It's concrete. And many employers still do value degree holders, and the more degrees, the better. In addition, as a side note, people in the romantic relationships, they tend to be impressed with people who have more degrees. It may even help you get a higher quality romantic partner. The question is, for you, is a degree or an additional degree, and this is the operative issue, is it the wisest use of your time and money? Barbara, your thoughts on this?
Well, as you've heard me say many times before, there is a summit that's put on by Arizona State and Silicon Valley that I've had the good fortune of attending for a number of years, and they have business panels as well as education panels. And the business panels have been really clear in the last couple of years, and it's a complete turnaround from everything I ever believed, but they have said unequivocally, we're not interested in your degree, we're interested in do you have the skills, can you do the stuff we want you to do, period. So I'm not sure that we are still, I'm sure there are some people and some companies still in that you must have a degree as a minimum.
A lot. There really are a lot still.
But it's changing.
Yeah, I think it's changing slowly. It's interesting. Okay. What I think I want to do is I'm always, because I've done the show for 28 and a half years, I don't want to ever think, is this sounding stale? This is sounding like the same old stuff. So I want to try another experiment today. And that is, I wrote a short story. It takes about 5 minutes to read. That, and I hopefully perform it so it doesn't feel like I'm reading a monotone, I wrote it, it's related to career stuff, and I wrote it with my KLW listeners in mind. And I'm curious, first of all, I'll read it, then Barbara, I'll ask you for your reaction, then I'll go to the phones and ask you if you have any reactions. I'm calling it, it's called Playing by the Rules, a short story about success. Decker, it's his name, we're giving him the name Decker, had become a millionaire, largely, because he played by the rules. Yes, he could have a fancy car, but it must look understated. Silver Lexus, not red Corvette. His clothes need look inconspicuously expensive. For example, the tiny black and white word Faconable on the shirt, not the bright green Izod allocator. Decker was tired at the end of his venture capitalist workday, but the rules deem visible fatigue or any emotion other than mild pleasantness unacceptable. So Decker took a deep breath, struggled out of his car, and turned his game demeanor back on for his second shift, the one at the club's bar. That demeanor was well practiced. Of course, shoulders back, head slightly above 90 degrees to look confident but not pompous. No matter how tired you are, you must stride, not trudge, but not so fast that you seem hurried. As the old commercial said, never let them see you sweat. Inside the bar, the stride must give way to a confident amble, but certainly not the padding of an insecure wannabe. He had tried out dozens of smiles in front of a mirror until he settled on the one that appeared most natural and which brought out the best in his facial features. And Decker practiced it until it was firmly in muscle memory and could be summoned on command. On seeing his fellow denizens at the bar or in the clubby chairs, Decker nodded with that crafted smile, varying it just enough to avoid that smile appearing pasted. At this point, he could have approached them without paying the price of seeming too anxious, but he preferred to slow his amble and slide to the bar, hoping that someone would ask him to join them. You see, the rule is that the power resides in the recipient of the request, not in the requester. Decker wouldn't even call the bartender, even though she was looking in the other direction and wasn't busy. Decker waited until she saw him. Thus, when she finally did, she might feel the need to apologize, whereupon Decker would graciously say, "Not a problem," all of which conveys to any onlookers that Decker was a gracious good egg. "I'd like a beefeater martini, please. The right drink, the right gin." So as usual, Decker had laid his foundation properly. And as a result, before even his drinky-poo had arrived, Bill Oliver, a fellow venture capitalist, sidled up. All clubby types had read How to Win Friends and Influence People, or one of its myriad derivatives, and they knew to not talk business too quickly. So although they had not the slightest interest in each other's family or their hobbies or other innocuities, that was the requisite discussion for the first 5 minutes. Decker kept a list of the names of even casual acquaintances, spouses, and kids, and their core interests, so he could toss off, for example, "Oh, Bill, I remember last time we spoke, you mentioned you were hoping Bradley'd be getting into choate. Any luck?" Decker would not, of course, say, "I recall you were trying to pull strings to get Bradley into choate." That would violate the rule against willfulness. Decker and Bill were in the middle of their pre-deal dance when Decker's phone rang. "Would you excuse me a moment? It's my boss." Decker ambled to a quiet spot and listened. "I'm so sorry to have to tell you this, Decker, but I wanted to let you know as soon as the decision had been made. Decker, we've decided to go in a different direction." Decker could not maintain his "the rules" demeanor. "What do you mean, a different direction? I've been an above-average performer. What is this about? What do you mean you're looking for someone with a fresher... what? A fresher approach? Are you firing me because I'm an older white male? No, you wouldn't even admit that if you were." Decker then realized that his show of emotion could hurt the reference he'd get, and perhaps his severance. So he mustered as much restraint as he could. "Oh, James, I am sorry. Thank you for letting me know." And he hung up. Decker couldn't muster an amble. He plodded back to Bill and simply says, I need to go. We'll continue this next time." Of course, Decker knew there might well not be a next time, but the rules prohibit such candor unless it's expedient. He drove home and told his wife, who said all the right things, including telling him, "Feel free to take a week or so off to regain your bearings." Internally, with him being the primary breadwinner supporting a lifestyle, including two kids in private school, she was nervous. "He's only 50 and he's only got soft skills. Will he get a job without or having to dip into savings?" But she never imagined what Decker ended up doing. Yes, he took a week to think about it all, but his conclusion was unexpected, utterly unexpected. Decker entered an ashram and renounced all his worldly goods. I won't regale you with all the details. I'll merely let you know that when he did it, she divorced him. Oh, and I should tell you that he went onto the Berkeley campus with $100,000 in $100 bills. He flung them all into the air and enjoyed the anti-materialistic Berkeley students swarming, diving, fighting for as many bills as they could grab. After 3 months of meditating, chanting, and eating locally grown sustainable organic vegetables over fair-traded brown rice, Decker was bored. Then one day, as he was padding around the ashram, yes, in an ashram, padding is the rule, he noticed an unused utility room that faced a busy street. He got permission to open a bookstore and cafe there called the Town Hall Meeting Cafe. On the cafe's website, anyone could sign up to lead a 1-hour discussion on any topic. Also, There were read-alouds for children, read-alouds for teens, read-alouds for adults, and read-alouds for seniors. Everybody loves being read aloud to. Hopefully you do as I'm reading this. Such events attracted a good number of customers who stayed a long time and thus often bought food and drink and occasionally, with the goodwill acquired, bought a book, even though they could use Amazon to peruse a far bigger selection at a far lower price. Decker ended up only netting $15 an hour, but was much happier than he was as a venture capitalist. Oh, and his wife? She used part of the divorce settlement to get an MBA and then got hired by Decker's former employer. And that's it. That is my little short story playing by the rules. Barbara, we only have 2 minutes. Any reactions? I hope you have.
Well, it's somewhat unlikely. I was surprised.
It's based on a true story. I know somebody who
usually get called in a bar after work and unceremoniously told that you're fired. I mean, that where's the backup? Where are the evaluations? Where's the et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? But it kept my attention.
You know, this is actually based on a true story. The husband of one of my clients had a corporate job. He quit and joined an ashram, and that was the kind of the genesis of this. This is not, you know, I thought you were going to go there as that being unrealistic, and yet that really was that was true. I think every human being on the planet has a crisis where they thought they went the whole wrong way. I have had on this show, I had a minister and a rabbi, and both of them admitted sometimes having grave doubts as to whether there was a God. People who work for nonprofits, sometimes whether it was worth giving it all for the cause. People certainly in corporate America saying, am I spending my life here so I can afford a Lexus rather than a Toyota and giving my soul to selling a widget? I think many people have these major crises of meaning. Barbara Nemco, honestly, have you ever had a thought? You've spent your entire life in education. You've risen to the top. You're many award-winning superintendent of schools. Do you ever have serious doubts as to whether you chose the right path?
Years ago, I think when I was in my early 40s, you may recall I considered stopping what I was doing and going to law school. Hmm. So, yeah, I've had that. And I probably would have done that if I hadn't realized that going to law school didn't mean I was going to get to only learn about the kind of law I wanted to practice, which would have been marriage and family law, but I would have had to do trusts and wills and business and all of those things about which I have zero interest. So the thought of having to spend all that time reading all that boring stuff and competing with 20-year-olds was not appealing.
Hey, you know, time is up, but I just had an idea. 10 or 15 years from now when you retire, I'm wondering if you might want to be a mediator, whether it be mediating disputes between the unions and management or even relationship being a mediator. You're so good. I think that would be a fabulous thing for you. What's your yes, thumbs up or thumbs down, because we don't have time. Like it or don't like it?
Thumbs up, depending on the training it would take.
Not that much. There's a lot of short training programs. Anyway, that is Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Thursday at 7. You can call in for a workover. Plus, the reigning current self-help guru is Jordan Peterson. He offers 11 pieces of career advice. I substantially agree with 8 and substantially disagree with 3. I'll share all. Until then, this is Marty Nemco for Barbara Nemco, reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.